Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, and particularly to Roxanne Missingham, the Parliamentary Librarian, thanks for coming on today for what I think is a very timely Vital Issues seminar. And firstly, I'd like to thank Roxanne and the Library for organising this, and I'm sure that everyone will get great value from it. Today, the topic is carbon tax and emissions trading, and it's interesting that, as I say, it is very topical. Yesterday, in Parliament, the CSIRO were here presenting their views on climate change and the latest on science, as they see it. Today, of course, as we say, we've got carbon tax and emissions trading, and given that the emissions trading system that the government's proposing in its carbon pollution reduction scheme legislation is generating considerable public debate, I think today's seminar will certainly help clarify some of the issues around the proposals that are being put there. I think it's also very timely given that some of this is becoming, as I say, it's being discussed a lot. It's also, I think, becoming slightly controversial in as much that with the global financial downturn, the debate is certainly becoming a lot more focused on the impact of these various options that have been considered. But today we have three expert speakers on this issue. We have Dr. Danny Price from Frontier Economics. We have Dr. Richard Dennis from the Australian Institute and Dr. Regina Betts from the University of New South Wales, all eminently qualified in their own way to give us their views. Each speaker will talk for up to 20 minutes, and then there will be questions, and we will finish before 2 o'clock so that members of the House and the Senate will be able to escape for we know what. Our first speaker, as I say, is Dr. Danny Price of Frontier Economics. He's the Managing Director. He's had over 20 years of policy and advisory experience in infrastructure, energy, resources, and climate change. Danny played a key role in energy reforms in New South Wales, which were a precursor to the establishment of the national electricity market. He was also instrumental in establishing Australia's first greenhouse gas reduction scheme, the New South Wales Greenhouse Gas Abatement Scheme. More recently, Danny has led work on modelling the economic impact of the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme proposals and of alternative approaches to emissions trading. He's going to talk today about alternative approaches to a cap and trade style emissions trading scheme, and he's, as is the government has proposed, as I think people are aware, a conventional cap and trade style scheme, and its recent draft legislation, of course, as I say, is a carbon pollution reduction scheme. So, ladies and gentlemen, could I ask you to give a very warm welcome to Mr. Danny Price from Frontier Economics.
Let me just clarify that Dr. Danny Price, it's, that PhD was awarded to me by the now head of the High Court, Justice French, in a judgment he made, and where I was an expert witness, he referred to me as Dr. Price, and it's sort of stuck. I don't have a PhD. So I figure if it's awarded by the Federal Court, no one can take it away from me. So, what I've been asked to speak to you about today is about an alternative scheme. It's really not that alternative to what's been proposed by the Commonwealth Government. It's in fact a variation of it, but whilst it's a minor variation, it has quite a material impact on the outcomes on the national economy. And the view that I take is that if you can come up with a scheme that has far less severe adverse economic impact, then we ought to be looking very closely at that. I know that everyone says that we've had this debate about alternative structures, but I've been involved in this debate from the beginning, and I can't remember that debate. I remember it being dismissed in Gano in a alternatives in about a paragraph in a couple of telephone books of documents, but So we've been very interested to try and generate a more complete debate about the costs and benefits of alternative schemes. We predicted that in the absence of that debate, then that debate will be conducted in Parliament in a less informed way, because there really was an absence of framework to think about the alternatives. I think that's what's going to happen. I think it's worth probably just reflecting on the policy environment, which you're all familiar with, but it also should reveal a little bit about where I'm coming from. I think the nature of the policy problem is that there's looming evidence, whether you believe in greenhouse or not. I think there's a sort of looming body of work that demonstrates that there's a requirement for fast, effective policy response to a global climate change. The real economic problem, economists are very interested in these things, is that wherever you have a policy where all the costs are up front and all the benefits are further into the future, if you have immediate tension between now and future generations and political interests now versus the future. And this is a classic case where there's massive costs up front, but potentially massive benefits down the back end, but in an unknown time frame. To make that problem more acute is that the costs and benefits are distributed differentially throughout the economy. So immediately have tension between different economic agents and basically vested interests. We also know that it's a global problem. From a technical point of view, there's very little Australia can do, but from a policy point of view, a demonstration effect of an effective policy could be a very powerful thing indeed in terms of adoption of greenhouse schemes around the world. And these problems really sort of revolve around, in the first instance, in the size of the target. If you don't have a meaningful target, then there's very little reason to be implementing a policy that just costs the economy without the resulting greenhouse gas reduction benefits. the debate so far has tended to focus on scheme design, but as you can see, that debate's sort of shifting back to how meaningful the targets are. Where I think these two things intersect is that with a more effective scheme design, and what I mean by that is one that has less adverse economic impacts, it's more likely more meaningful targets would be adopted. So they're not unrelated. And I'd like to talk about an alternative scheme design, which I think would, and in fact I know, will produce far less adverse economic impacts. If you think about all the different scheme designs that have been discussed, taxes, classic cap and trade, intensity-based schemes, baselining credit, they all try and do the same things. They're all trying to shift the relative economics towards cleaner activity in terms of lower emission activity. And they do so in different types of ways. So, but in the process of switching the relative cost from high emission activity to low emission activity, it produces absolute price effects. And it's those absolute price effects, i.e. high prices of factory inputs and product outputs, that's the thing that concerns policymakers, because they are the things that sort of filter through the economy, causes things like carbon leakage, unemployment, decline in economic growth, the things that policymakers are concerned about. Policymakers like a vibrant economy, and it's in everybody's interest to have that. So, so what are the alternative scheme designs? Now I'm going to be scanning through this pretty quickly. We go in some submissions which have been completely ignored by Garnaut and the Green Paper in some more detail, using a standard illustrative example about the mechanics of these different schemes. So what I really wanted to do today was just roughly skate over the different three alternative schemes. The classic cap and trade, which underpins the CPRS, of course, that works by charging for all emissions. This is a quite important point in understanding the value of the alternative that I'm going to present today. So I've tried to characterise that as a purely sticks approach in terms of the carrots and sticks analogy. So this is basically anything you emit, you get charged for. And that will most definitely work. There's no doubt that a classic cap and trade scheme will produce the outcome of reducing emissions for a hard cap. There's no doubt in my mind about it. But it produces some very severe economic outcomes. The carbon tax works in a similar type of way, in that it charges for all emissions. It's also, therefore, would be characterised as a purely sticks approach, with my little analogy. I think The illusion, though, is that the benefit of a tax scheme is that it's going to provide greater certainty, because people, the logic is that once you've applied a tax, then the tax will be a more certain price for producers and consumers, and therefore people can make decisions about investments more accurately. But I think that is simply an illusion. I think what will end up happening is the tax will get constantly adjusted to meet an emissions target, because inevitably you're going to get the tax wrong at some point in time, and the emissions outcomes won't be acceptable. And if not this government, future governments will seek to alter those taxes to get the right greenhouse outcome, because that's, after all, why you're doing it. The third approach is what's often referred to as an intensity-based approach, and that works by quite differently. It doesn't charge for all emissions. It charges for any emission above a benchmark level. So if you think about the carbon pollution reduction scheme, it starts counting the cost of carbon from zero emissions. The way an intensity-based scheme works is it doesn't necessarily start from zero emissions, it could start from a higher level. But it has another aspect to it. Because the cost signal is weakened somewhat, you can strengthen that cost signal by inducing cleaner behaviour. So if somebody undertakes action that is positive in terms of reducing emissions, then this type of scheme rewards people. So there's both a reward and a penalty for high emission behaviour, and it's all done relative to a clean benchmark. It's not a novel concept. it's been applied in Australia. For example, the New South Wales GCAS scheme, which is in fact a carbon-only arrangement, is in fact an intensity-based scheme, and that's been working now for a number of years. And so that only rewards, it doesn't penalise bad behaviour. And that has led to 70 or 80 million tonnes of abatement, and you haven't heard a peep about it. And that's because the lack of severity of economic impacts that filter through the rest of the economy, yet you're achieving substantial greenhouse gas reductions. So I wouldn't mind just talking a bit more about that, but before I do, it's often said that the cap and trade is in fact the standard model, and that Australia ought to be following the international standard. Well, it's not. Here's just a couple of examples. There's many, many other examples I've put up, but I'll start with Australia. So we have a cap and trade, tax, and intensity approach. Well, the CPRS, in fact, purports to be a cap and trade, but by way of the mechanism for compensating trade-exposed energy-intensive users, it in fact converts it to a poor man's intensity scheme. So in fact it's a blend of the two. Switzerland, as you can see, has a range of different mechanisms that are meant to work in complement. EU, USA, cap and trade, that's the Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Interestingly, if you have a look at the RGGI, which is regarded as a success, if you have a look at the price that's produced in that market, it's $3, just $3. And the reason why it's $3 is because it's not a meaningful cap. $3 ends up being just a nuisance tax. So the RTGI, which is a cap and trade, is in fact converts to a tax. So it purports to be a cap and trade, but given the weakness of the target, that the cost actually doesn't do anything to shift the relative costs of cleaner and dirtier activity. Korea has a complement of cap and trade and intensity, Japan similarly. In Canada, which I banged on about a bit, which I'll explain in more detail today, has proposed an intensity-based approach, but they've now put that on hold for two key reasons. One is that the government's in a bit of state of flux. And secondly, they had been pursuing that with a view to going alone as compared to the US. That's obviously now shifted. They're waiting to see what the US will do, because they're very, very dependent on trade with the US, so they're quite keen to make sure they do something that's not inconsistent with them. Canada's got a bad rap, I think, because of the context in which that scheme is being developed, i.e. to protect the oil sands projects, which are high emission activities by any stretch of the imagination. But put that aside, think about the mechanics of these schemes rather than the context in which they've been applied. I think what's very interesting is if you look at the, if you recall going back to the people who are doing what, if you have a look at who is looking at intensity schemes, you will see there that Australia, Canada, Switzerland, people who have got massive exposure to world trade, are proposing intensity-based schemes. And this sort of alerts you to, you know, why. Well, the reason why is because they have far less severe impacts on the relative trade position of a country. And so Australia, Canada and Switzerland have a big interest as relatively small open economies in getting a scheme that has that is effective in terms of reducing greenhouse gases, but doesn't damage their local industry. And that really reflects, that damaged local industry is the concerns that people have about so-called carbon leakage, and that is, for anyone who doesn't know, the risk that you push industry offshore into, in fact, higher emission production in another country. And that's of no value to solving the greenhouse gas problem at all. In fact, it could actually worsen economic welfare around the globe in that international trade has been has underpinned great improvements in poverty and global wealth. And if you produce more expensively in other countries, then all you're doing is degrading economic welfare. It doesn't make much sense. And I think the last point is a critical one. I'm often told that because I'm proposing an alternative, that somehow I'm undermining our ability to interact with the international community in terms of carbon emission trading. Well, it's not the case. These schemes are highly compatible. So, you know, for example, the European Emissions Trading Scheme, which is a classic cap and trade, works hand in hand with the Clean Development Mechanism, which is a baselining credit, which is exact same form that New South Wales GeoGas scheme operates under. So,
a reminder to all building occupants.
So very different schemes can operate in under the same arrangements. And as I've highlighted, different schemes would be, it'd be better to have schemes that are more suited to the economic conditions of each economy. And to that degree, that's going to improve economic welfare and the likelihood that these schemes will be adopted. So let me just tell you a bit more about the intensity-based approach, because you may not have heard about it very much. So the government sets an emissions intensity target by way of a clean benchmark, and you can do that for a sector, an industry, or an activity. The benchmark can be set at any level. In fact, one of the key differences between the CPRS and intensity-based scheme is that the CPRS effectively sets the benchmark at zero. So anything above zero, you get priced for. It need not be that way. You can move the benchmark at which you start counting the cost of carbon further up, remembering that all you have to do is you have to shift the relative price of clean activity from dirtier activity to make cleaner production activity relatively more economically attractive. You don't have to damage industry along the way. And it's often said that the intensity-based scheme won't achieve the same greenhouse outcome. Well, that's completely wrong. You can set an intensity target to achieve exact same emissions reduction as a hard and fast CPRS-type target can. It's just where you set the target. And as I've indicated, the way it works is that if you're above that benchmark, you pay for your emissions above it. If you're below it, you get rewarded. Well, what do we mean by reward? Well, the reward is that people who produce below the benchmark get to create a clean permit, which they then sell to the people who demand it, who are required to buy a permit. So in this way, the trade is actually occurring. The supply side of the market are the clean producers, and the demand side of the market are the dirtier producers who actually need these permits. So the trade is actually occurring in between the cleaner and dirtier producers, rather than having the government create these permits, require people to buy it, and then take the money and then compensate them back again for the effects on their industry, and in the process, churning huge quantities of revenue through the federal government. And if you think that won't create its own economic distortions in the future, where money won't go back perfectly to adversely affected users, it will get filtered off, at least some of it, to other meritorious requirements, which may almost certainly create its own inefficiencies. So that completely avoids the churning problem that you have with the current CPRS. So you don't have the cost, the overhead, You don't have the working capital requirement on the industry to go out and buy these permits. The industry is actually operating this scheme themselves. And so cleaner activity, and that could be consumers who, for example, want to reduce their emissions intensity, well, they can benefit from that. They can appropriate the gains from their own positive activity by selling those gains to the people who require those certificates. And the moment that I've got a source of revenue for my cleaner activity, which tends to be associated with higher costs of production, so and that's our economic problem, is that cleaner activity costs more. Well, if I can subsidise my production costs with another source of revenue, i.e. the clean permit, then immediately I've changed the economics to clean production. And the target will determine just how much additional revenue I can make as a clean producer. So let me just illustrate that a little bit. So this graph is on the vertical axis is only in terms of emissions per unit of output. And then I have a high emitter and a low emitter. I establish my clean energy benchmark. Anyone above it, that's a liability. Anyone below it, the surplus is sold. And the value of that surplus, the dollar value of that surplus, changes the relative cost. And the dollar value of my liability changes the relative cost. So I switch the relative cost of those two activities. That clean benchmark can be applied to any industry. So for example, the CPRS already has a basis for compensation. They have a benchmark already in the CPRS legislation that says we will compensate aluminium, steel, pulp and paper by a certain percentage. So it can't be that much more difficult to apply it to the same activities or more activities. So you can see the mechanics of it. It's only a very minor change to the CPRS. So this doesn't, as often we say, oh, you can do that for electricity, but not for other sectors. Well, you can. You can do it for airlines, you can do it for anything. And in fact, if you have a look at the way in which the global sectoral agreements have been developed, it's in fact along these lines. So in fact, the trend is not towards cap and trade schemes. The trend is the way more towards intensity-based schemes, including places like China. So the intensity-based scheme has several benefits, but the biggest are that the absolute price effects are much, much less severe. And that obviously goes to the question of carbon leakage and the concern, the broader sort of general equilibrium effects throughout the economy. The government isn't involved in churning this massive amount of revenue. Industry doesn't therefore have to find the money, which is a very difficult thing at the moment and probably for the next few years, to buy these permits. One thing that that people haven't realised is that the intensity schemes don't let high emitters off the hook. So one of the things that you've seen, I've read in the paper yesterday, that higher oil prices have caused a demand response, and that has that now means that there should be a relief of from consumers and producers for their emissions obligations. Well, this type of scheme wouldn't let that happen. So if I have to emit at a certain rate, it doesn't matter whether the economy is booming or busting, you still have to work hard to reduce your emissions. It's a relatively minor change to CPRS. It doesn't require the government going back to the drawing board. I've said the point about the international trading, but just to give you an idea of the difference in outcomes, one of the things that we do a lot of is the electricity industry, electricity and gas, and we've modelled the effect of these different schemes on the Australian energy national electricity market. The baseline, the Department of Climate Change reference case, the electricity prices in terms of long-run marginal cost, that's that dark blue line. The green paper or the CPRS is this red line in terms of effect. We then model the, I've called it the Canadian cap and trade, because it is a cap and trade. It's just a variant of it. Exact same emissions reduction, the exact same time, and modelled it to be the same environmental outcome. And you can see the price effects are very, very different. So it's not to say that you get away with no price effects. You can see as time goes on, you get an increasingly similar price effect. But if you have a look at that, by 2020, you're not above the base case price. So immediately that gives you a massive buffer in which you can implement a scheme It then takes away this argument about the requirement for a delay in the scheme because you're not having the same adverse effects in the scheme. The fact that initially it starts off lower also allows you to go in with a harder target with very little additional effect. So these schemes are really worthwhile. If you want to understand the sort of the magnitude of the effects of this, if you apply that at a national level, you're looking, in our own macroeconomic modelling, you're looking at hundreds of billions of dollars of difference in terms of the cost effect flowing on through the economy if you just apply that just to electricity, let alone all the other sectors. So it is a massive issue, and to me it relieves a lot of the sort of policy constraints that you're currently witnessing. That's more than my 1 minute.
Thank you very much indeed for, I think, an excellent presentation, and I'm sure that will set the scene for the other two speakers and give a very good introduction to, and more than just an introduction, a very good explanation about what's in offering on this. Our second speaker is Dr. Richard Dennis, who's going to talk about the carbon tax approach. Dr. Dennis is the Executive Director of the Australia Institute. He's an economist with a particular interest in the role of regulation, and prior to taking up his current position, he was an associate professor at the Crawford School of Economics and Government at the ANU, where he continues to hold an adjunct appointment. Dr. Dennis has also worked as strategy advisor to the leader of the Australian Greens, Senator Bob Brown, chief of staff to the leader of the Australian Democrats, Senator Scott Despoja, and he's lectured in economics at the University of Newcastle. He's published extensively in academic journals and newspapers, and he's also a co-author of some books, including one that's coming out shortly. And ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to ask you to give a very warm welcome to Dr. Richard Dennis.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for coming. And look, there'll be no PowerPoint today. Power corrupts, and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. So apologies to the other speakers. I'm too lazy to prepare. I'm down to talk about a carbon tax today, which I'm more than happy to do, but I need to clarify a few things at the outset. I think a carbon tax is better than a badly designed emissions trading scheme. There's a value judgment in there. What's a badly designed emissions trading scheme? And, you know, we can have questions about, can't you have a badly designed carbon tax as well? Yes, you can. But I guess I just want to clarify, I'm not here to say scrap the CPRS, have a carbon tax. I think there's a lot of ways you could make it a lot better. I'll talk about them a bit today. But if push comes to shove, for me, if it was a choice between a fundamentally flawed emissions trading scheme and a carbon tax, then I'd settle for a carbon tax any day, and I'll explain why. But to do that, and that's what I have to focus on first in my talk today, I need to talk about what's wrong with the CPRS. Because my whole argument hinges not that a carbon tax is perfect, my argument hinges on the fact that it's easier to design a better carbon tax than a really bad CPRS. So the first point I want to make is that the CPRS doesn't look anything like what my economics textbooks tell me an emissions trading scheme looks like. So we have this phony fight, we have this phony argument, is emissions trading better or worse than a carbon tax? Well, that doesn't help us here in Parliament, because Parliament passes laws, not policies. And the laws that we're looking at, the draft regulations for the CPRS, propose a model of emissions trading that bears none of the major attributes of a textbook emissions trading scheme. Let me go through the major attributes of a textbook emissions trading scheme. One, it's a solution to a form of market failure. So if you think there's too much pollution, figure out how much pollution you want and set the target accordingly. The CPRS targets have got nothing to do with the underlying problem. But the only reason you have an emissions trading scheme is to tackle a problem. The problem is, of course, that we're putting out and have been putting out for far too long far too much CO2. So scientific evidence suggests 25% bare minimum, 40% probably more likely, emission reduction by 2020, not that far away, 11 years. So let's say 25% is a bare minimum. Science says 25%, CPRS says 5% to 15%. So step one in why economists think emissions trading is a good idea is because once you've defined the problem, emissions trading is a good way to get you to that endpoint. But the CPRS does not seek to get to the point that we need to get to. And I'll come back to some of the weird and bizarre consequences of using emissions trading and deliberately setting the wrong cap. So step one, we just got the first premise wrong. We've set the target at the wrong level. Step two, well, everyone knows step two, you auction the permits. The purpose of emissions trading is not just to cap, that's the primary purpose of the cap, but the other advantage of an emissions trading scheme is you can raise a lot of revenue. So you collect a hell of a lot of revenue, and you can do that to do a whole bunch of other things, including reduce income tax, reduce payroll tax, reduce the GST, do whatever the hell you want. You introduce one tax, and it allows, which is an economically good tax, it's an efficient tax because you're solving a market failure, and you can use the revenue to do other things that are good, be it invest in energy efficiency, although only under some certain circumstances, or reduce other taxes. But at step two, auction the permits, we fell over and are giving away up to 90% of the permits for free to the most to the biggest polluters, the so-called emission intensive trade exposed. So step one, set the target, we got that wrong. Step two, auction the permits, we got that wrong. Step three is not even in the textbook. What we've done with the CPRS is said, well, the textbook says let the market set the price. Right, because market forces, market mechanisms, market. I'm an economist, markets are nice. However, if the market price gets to $40 a tonne under the CPRS, what do? Print up new permits. It is not a cap and trade scheme. There is no cap in the cap and trade scheme. Because if polluters really, really want to pollute, so much so that the scarce permits that have been issued get driven up to $40, the government, like the Zimbabwean Reserve Bank, will start printing up some new ones. It's not even a cap and trade scheme, leaving aside that the cap is initially set at the wrong level and that we're giving away far too many free permits. So I'm going to talk about a carbon tax because that's important, but again, intellectually, my view is not that carbon taxes are perfect and emissions trading is terrible. We have to look at specifics. The proposed model here is quite flawed. So step two is, well, how would you make it better? Well, there's a really obvious thing called get the targets right, and I don't really need to add to that, especially if people heard from the scientists recently. They're worried about it. I'm an economist. I just listen to them. Step two, however, of how to fix it, apart from how to get the targets right, is to tackle what is, I think, one of the more bizarre and until recently, perhaps still recently, poorly understood design features of emissions trading. And that is that once you allocate a certain number of permits, whether it's for 2010 or 2020 or in between, once those permits are in circulation, that's the level of pollution you're going to get. That's what emissions trading does. You say, well, we're going to say how much pollution we want, and we're going to let the market go and figure out who does the polluting. The bizarre twist of combining an emissions trading scheme with a target that's well below what the science says you need is that if individuals who look at the collectively set target, and by collectively I mean set on our behalf by the parliament, if individuals or state governments or anyone else looks at the target and says, well, that's a bit pathetic, that's actually motivating me to go and try harder. It's motivating me to go and do even more. Once the CPRS comes in, any emission reductions achieved by individuals, achieved by companies, or achieved by state governments will simply free up permits for someone else to increase their pollution. Now, this is not actually privately disputed by anybody. It's publicly disputed still by Minister Wong and, you know, some people who speak on her behalf, but privately they say, Richard, it's a design feature. Why are you going on and on about it? And I'm going on and on about it because the Commonwealth Government will offer you $7,000 if you'll put at least $8,000 of your own money to put a solar panel on your roof, which won't reduce emissions by a single kilogram. And I just think there's some fraud, and I'm choosing my words carefully here, there's some fraud being undertaken when we're actively encouraging people to do their bit, when their bit is to free up permits to allow someone else to increase their pollution. In the economics textbook, again, this wouldn't really surface as a problem, because if you were setting the target at the right level, there would be no need for individuals to go and waste their own hard-earned trying to make up the gap between what the government's done and where we need to get to. So if you had a well-designed emissions trading scheme with a scientifically based target, well, if people wanted to go do quirky voluntary things, you know, well, then I'd be no more concerned about that than people putting spoilers on the back of their car. I mean, you know, they don't really make you go faster. Waste your own money. What do I care? But in an environment where the target is deliberately set well below what the science says we need, with a Commonwealth and less so, but state governments actively encouraging people, get out there and waste your own money and do your bit, I take offence. I think that's bad policy. And I think it's misleading deliberately. Now, some people, and this is getting to why a carbon tax, I think, has got some benefits. Some people might argue, well, that's all a bit dinky, Richard. Few people, you know, faffing around with solar panels on their roof, small beer. Not true. When the Rudd government announced it was going to spend $4 billion spending your money, my money, and the taxpayers' money putting insulation into the roofs, 2 million houses, $4 billion. Kevin Rudd walked into Parliament and stood up and announced the scheme and said, I'm going to spend $4 billion and that's going to reduce Australia's emissions by 50 million tonnes. What he meant to say, of course, was no, it won't. It won't reduce emissions by a single kilogram. It will reduce households' energy use and therefore the household sector's emissions by 50 million tonnes, freeing up 50 million tonnes worth of permits for someone else to expand their pollution. Now, why would a Prime Minister walk into Parliament and say, I'm going to reduce emissions by 50 million tonnes if he's not planning to? I don't know. I just keep asking the question. Now, the thing is, you could fix the CPRS quite simply in such a way that if the federal government wants to spend $4 billion to reduce emissions, and the federal government thinks it's just reduced emissions by 50 million tonnes, then next year, issue 50 million fewer permits. It's not hard. And for any who are still confused by this debate, we've got time for questions at the end. But, you know, under sustained questioning, Minister Wong at a press conference last week admitted that when the government says emission reductions will be 5 to 15% in 2020, 5 to 15%, fortunately, one journalist at least was willing to pursue the issue and said, hang on, if we all do our bit, if we do this, this and this, can we get to 16, can we get to 17? And finally she said, no, no. The government's picked the target of 5 to 15%. So, what's wrong with the CPRS as opposed to what's wrong with emissions trading? Targets are deeply flawed. We're giving away too many permits rather than auctioning them. We've created a system in which where individuals who try and go further simply free up permits for someone else. What do we do about it? Well, fix the targets, fix the problem with voluntary stuff. But if you can't or you won't fix those things, I think, and this is, you know, I don't think it's a naive perspective, but I'm happy if people disagree. I think a carbon tax gives you a lot more flexibility and in turn a lot of advantages going forward. If you could have a well-designed emissions trading scheme, I'd relax. But a badly designed emissions trading scheme locks in failure. A badly designed emissions trading scheme stipulates not what this Parliament will do. A badly designed emissions trading scheme mandates basically what will happen between now and 2020, and arguably out to 2025, but let's just say 2020 to keep it simple. And what that means is when the science gets worse, And I say when because every IPCC report gets worse. When the science gets worse, and the next parliament looks at this issue and says, oh, okay, we were probably a little timid with our 5% target and our 15% target, let's go further. We're making decisions, allegedly by June this year, that lock in the next three parliaments to a very expensive, very ineffective mechanism. And if you want to change it in 2010, and you want to change it in 2012, and you want to change it in 2015, then it's going to be much harder to change than a carbon tax. Now, I'm not saying for a second, please, I've worked in politics a few times, we all have probably, that the politics of setting a carbon tax will be easy. Of course they won't. And of course there's going to be the same snouts in the same trough, and of course there's going to be the same flexible arm getting twisted behind whoever the government of the day is. That's okay. But a carbon tax, if it were introduced this year, and I repeat, as a replacement to a deeply flawed emissions trading scheme, there's no carbon tax that the government could introduce this year that would prevent a subsequent parliament from changing it. And there would be no compensation payable for an increase in a carbon tax in the future. I mean, I don't remember, you know, previous increases in income tax or corporate tax. Remember in the days when taxes went up? It's a long time ago. But I never heard anyone, when tax rates go up, saying, oh, your government's put the tax rate up, I'm owed compensation here. But look what's happened with water down the Murray. We gave away too many water rights, and now it costs you and I a fortune to buy them back. And frankly, that's what this whole scheme is about. It's about locking us into failure. It's about well-organised people who've got much longer time horizons, not just than the average Australian, but the average Australian government. People who've spent 15 years successfully preventing anything from happening, locking in a scheme that delivers them certainty. Because what we're effectively doing is promising to let the polluters pollute a lot with a capped price between now and 2020. And if anything changes between now and then, it's your fault, it's your problem, it's my problem, and we've got to pay a hell of a lot in compensation to change it. That's what this is all about. It's about locking us into failure. And for those... Is it probably time to stop? Or?
Oh, come on,
okay, good, because I want to talk about the international stuff just briefly. The government is increasingly starting to run the line, not just, as the previous speaker said, that, you know, people who have got alternative ideas about how to do this, you know, they're some form of, you know, opposed to emissions trading or opposed to this. You know, they're starting to ramp up the rhetoric. It's only subtle, but watch this space. Basically, if you oppose the CPRS, you will be personally responsible for killing the polar bears. Right? That there is the government in Australia, and it's got its draft legislation, which is perfect. Perfect. Anyone saying this shouldn't be passed unless it's amended, let alone anyone that says the whole scheme might be a bit wonky, is personally going to be responsible for seeing Australia's emissions grow and the polar bears taking it. Well, here's a couple of things to keep in mind. One, all the people talking about soft starts and things for the CPRS, the CPRS is a soft start. Apart from the fact that it's 15 years too late, emissions actually rise for the first couple of years under the CPRS. So the idea that we have to hurry up and have the CPRS so that we can hurry up and start reducing our emissions, well, check out the white paper. There's no rush in the white paper. Emissions keep rising for the first couple of years. I think it's 3 years before they start to fall. So step one, the CPRS does not do anything urgent about emissions trading. But step two, which is I think far more important, is a big, big misunderstanding about whether we have emissions trading and when we have emissions trading in Australia and what's going on in Copenhagen and around the world. So let me make it quite simple for you, but in question time, feel free to push me a bit further on this. But to make it simple, the world does not care what we do. The world could not care less if we have a CPRS. The world could not care less what the design feature of the CPRS is. The world could not care less if we resuscitated Fidel Castro and brought him to Australia and said, could you run a command and control economy for us as long as we meet our international target? International emissions trading has got nothing to do with the development of domestic trading regimes. The two things have got nothing to do with each other. We will, or won't, but I think will, sign up to any international agreement that's put forward that says, right, Australia's emissions target for 2020 is X, where X, you know, is unlikely to be less than 20%. Keep in mind, CPRS is only 15. I'll come back to that if I've got time. But let's say, you know, we go to Copenhagen, the rest of the world twists our arm, and there is an international agreement, and there's a 20% target. We have not agreed how to get to that 20%. That is our domestic obligation. That is our problem. And whether we use a CPRS, and whether we use a carbon tax, or whether we use a command and control economy, or whether we use an intensity-based scheme, is of not of any concern to the rest of the world. The trading bit only comes in under two admittedly likely scenarios. One, Australia doesn't go within cooee of meeting our international obligations. In which case, the Commonwealth government, not Alcoa, not BlueScope, not any individual in this room, if we don't come, which we won't, within cooee of meeting our international targets, we have to buy bucket loads of credits off other countries. The CPRS actually prevents the sale of credits generated in Australia to other countries. The CPRS prohibits the sale of Australian permits overseas. There won't be many to worry about, so don't worry about it. But in a nutshell, we will have an international obligation to meet a particular target, and if we don't do it by reducing emissions, if we don't do it by having a domestic policy that works, we will just have a huge open-ended financial obligation as taxpayers to buy bucket loads of permits from other countries. In the unlikely circumstance where Australia goes beyond our target that's set for us, then the Commonwealth would be able to sell some permits to people overseas. And maybe we'd have a mechanism, maybe, that allowed individuals to do that, but the CPRS actually prevents it. So to conclude, Australia's emissions in 2020 will be exactly equal to our international obligation. Full stop. Whether the CPRS is passed or not, whether the CPRS is amended or not, we will meet our international obligation, or we will be in dispute with the rest of the world and there will be sort of sanctions, etc. But the CPRS is a way for us to domestically achieve that objective. Whether it's passed now, whether it's passed in the future, really doesn't matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard, and I think we're very clear on your views on what you think of the CPRS. Our next speaker is Dr. Regina Betts, and Dr. Betts is currently a senior lecturer in the University of New South Wales School of Economics and is a joint director of the Centre for Energy and Environmental Markets, and her area of academic interest is environmental economics. She holds a PhD from the German University of Administrative Science and the Speyer University, and a Master of Economics from the University of Trier in Germany. And she has recent publications on the European Emissions Trading Schemes, or Scheme, and I think Dr. Betts is going to speak today on the conventional cap and trade approach. So please welcome Dr. Regina Betts.
Welcome everybody, thank you for introducing me. I'm actually talking on comparing cap and trade schemes with taxes, just to follow up a little bit of what Richard has been talking before. But in my view, the whole debate about cap and trade versus taxes is not so helpful. I think where we actually need to focus on is on a coherent climate change policy mix. So that's why I'm going to start with what I think we actually need. Then I will talk a little bit on the theoretical, practical, and also international aspects of taxes versus cap and trade, where I'm drawing upon the European Emissions Trading Scheme lessons learned, talk a little bit about voluntary action and what might be some solutions there, about the recession, and then conclude. So, as I said, climate change is such a great challenge that we shouldn't rely on one policy instrument. We should actually build three pillars to work on our climate policy. And they would include technology policy, they would include regulation and information policies, and a carbon pricing. So carbon pricing, either a tax or an emissions trading scheme, would be just one pillar of this whole system, which would include other policies as well. And why am I so emphasizing that we need more than just an emissions trading scheme? The reason is that we have so many things we actually need to drive to achieve the stringent targets which the scientists are asking us in order to prevent dangerous climate change. We need people changing their behavior. You know, different ways of transport, different way of doing things what they have done before with a lot of electricity, now they have to do it with less. So we need some behavioral change happening. We also need substitution effects. That means fuel switch options, but also just consuming less emission-intensive products. And on the other hand, we also need technology, which is actually helping us to change our society and our economy. But when you look at this kind of policy mix, what we have, or the policy tools we are offered, we have the economic instruments where emissions trading is part of it. But what it drives usually, it's mainly good in driving substitution effects. It will have some behavioral change, and it will also have some dynamic impact on technological innovation. But there are other instruments which are much better, for example, in improving technology. And these are, you know, market engagement programs, strategic R&D investment, demonstration programs, or infrastructure programs. So we would need this type of instruments. You know, they might be linked, as we've seen in the white paper and the draft legislation, that, you know, some of the auction revenue might be used in order actually to finance those programs for carbon capture and storage, for example. But they are necessary to actually achieve the tough targets. And for behavioral changes, price instruments are not the best to drive changes, because the barriers are not really price barriers. The barriers are usually with regard to information. People don't know if this washing machine is consuming more electricity than another. They will need labeling or another policy which is actually helping them to make that right decision. So looking at a coherent and effective policy mix, I think this is actually what Australia needs to do, and not debating emission trading versus a tax. But as I'm pointing out, emissions trading or a tax or whatever, an economic instrument, is part of the solution, because you need this price signal to lead to substantial substitution effects. And so looking at carbon pricing rewards for individuals and firms that reduce emissions. So if you have a carbon price, it will give you an incentive to use more carbon-efficient technologies. As I said, it will have an impact on technology, but it's only through the price mechanism, and it's for some really big innovations like carbon capture and storage, it won't be enough. There wouldn't be, you know, there's a market failure. There's no company who can really do that on its own, inventing carbon capture and storage. So you have this problem that you need some public money to drive those investments. You will induce substitutions towards lower carbon fuels, that's the substitution effect. You will also create market potential for low carbon energy efficient innovations, and you will deliver the outcome because the carbon price will be fed through all of the products into your economy and in the consumption pattern for individual households. So I will have a higher price to pay for cement or whatever. Everything will kind of have an imputed carbon price included in the good, which will lead to structural change. And that's what we want. They want that I'm using maybe more likely wood products because, you know, they have less emission impact than, for example, cement or lime. So this is all intended, that we have structural and changes in substituting goods, and that we achieve an economy where we consume low emission intensive products. So emissions trading and carbon taxes, they are actually kind of theoretical twins. They both set a price on emissions, and they both aim to achieve emission reductions from where they are met at least cost. And under ideal conditions, we would actually have a carbon price which would equal the tax. That's kind of from a theoretical point of view. That would be, you know, they would be kind of similar. But the question is, where do we have information, and how does, for example, uncertainty play a role? And when we look at the discussion economists have on carbon taxes versus emissions trading, you might be familiar with this. Weizmann is one of the famous economists talking about that. There's all this discussion about the uncertainty. So if uncertainty comes into the game, and uncertainty means we are not sure where our mitigation costs lie, or how will be the damages, what kind of damages can we expect from from climate change, then there are some situations where a carbon tax is better dealing with the uncertainty, or an emissions trading is better dealing with it. It really depends mainly on the slope of the curves and about our beliefs. And so there was a lot of debate that carbon taxes would be better because they were assuming that the damage curve would be flat because we have this stock of atmospheric gases which is building up, and so it's a slow process. But more recently, there was a lot of talk from scientists that we actually might reach some tipping points where then actually our damage curve would be very, very inelastic, like we would, you know, we would have a very different slope. And then again, emissions trading schemes might be the more efficient option. So it's a theoretical debate where I wouldn't pay too much attention because, as I said, there are arguments for one and the other. What both actually need to do is they need to set a target. And as I said, this is difficult because you will rely on climate science to actually deliver you the quantities. And it, as Richard pointed out, minus 25 to 40 in 2020 are kind of what we hear from scientists would be the necessary reductions. Looking at it from a tax perspective, and that's where the discussion, I think Danny was mentioning it before, where the uncertainty comes in. If you want to achieve the same reductions by a tax, because you're not sure exactly how people will react, so if I'm imposing a tax of $40, it might be, you know, that I'm really stopping consuming as much fuel, but it might also be that I'm quite, not reacting a lot to $40. So the question is, how do people react? And then you might need actually to do a kind of trial and error with the tax in order to achieve a specific quantity, and that means you will not, you might get uncertainty for investment decisions also under a tax, very similar to an emissions trading scheme where you have a floating price. With energy intensive trade exposed industries, you will have the same problem, and I will give you some illustration that some of the kind of real practical examples have exempted those from taxes, and we've seen that a lot of free allocation was given or is given for trade exposed energy intensive industries under emissions trading scheme. stranded assets, same problem, and low-income distributional impacts would be the same problem as well. So you would need to use some of the tax revenue to actually redistribute it to low-income households, because those will be most likely having a higher impact because they have higher energy expenditure from their income, and so they will have a kind of a regressive impact from the emissions trading scheme. And that goes a little bit in the direction of Danny. If he's going, and that's, as I understand it, to give a lot of permits out for free based on these benchmarks, there won't be a lot of revenue, although there will be a pass-through of cost, because that's all about emissions trading, and that people are feeling that there are differences in the cost, and the more emission-intensive projects become more expensive. But you wouldn't have a revenue. And so it's very, very important to keep in mind that auctioning is important to also have money to give it to low-income households to lower regressive impacts. Coming now to the European Emissions Trading Scheme, and that's really one of my areas of research. So we are now in the second phase of the emissions trading scheme, and I think that's very important to note after Richard was talking. The European scheme was not locked in for 10 years, and it was not locked in with targets for 10 years. The European scheme started with a pilot phase from 2005 to 2007. So it was a three-year trial, and they learned a lot, and they have made a lot of changes afterwards. So what it does, it's covering about 27 EU member states and also three countries which are outside the European Union now, Norway, Liechtenstein and Iceland, and it covers about 46% of the EU emissions, so it's much smaller. It's not, and that's also different. The Australian scheme is going to cover about 70%, so that's a much larger coverage than this scheme. And it focuses mainly on electricity and the high emitting industries. It has a link to the international market via having the opportunity to use the Kyoto units, but it's limited. So that's also one of the big differences to the Australian scheme, that there's a limit on the use of Kyoto units. We are now in phase two, so at the beginning of phase two, so I don't really have a lot of lessons learned from phase two yet. We have flexibility in banking and borrowing within a period, but you can't borrow between periods. And there was no banking from the pilot phase to phase two, and that actually was one of the reasons why we had this price crash. You might have heard about it. The price dropped from around 30 euros to about 10 euros. And one of the reasons was that there was the information was revealed that there's no scarcity in the market, and that there's most likely no scarcity to be in the first phase, because the permits would become useless in the second phase because you couldn't bank them. Prices dropped to zero at the end of phase one. What are the cap and the allocation and the sanction processes? So in the first phase and the second phase, the cap was left to the member states. The cap in the second phase was mainly to achieve their Kyoto targets, because every member state had a Kyoto target to achieve. But the way how they were distributing the permits was left as well to the member states. And so there were about 27 national allocation plans. I was involved in working for the one in Germany and Luxembourg, and I can tell you that it was a big, complex thing with a lot of formulas, really a lot of problems in actually solving the free allocation. And the reason why there was so much free allocation in the European scheme was that there was the choice for the Commission to either get a scheme through where they leave the allocation, which will have all these distributional impacts, to the member state, but get the scheme through, or, you know, they would spend years and years debating how they are actually going to allocate the permits if it would have been, you know, centralized. That's why they decided to leave it up to the member state. They make these decisions, and they are fixing it now. So for the next phase, which is starting in 2013, the cap will be set centrally, and it will be a harmonized allocation, and there will be much more auctioning. it will be around 60% auctioning and the rest will be done on benchmarks. And coming back to what Danny was talking before, benchmarks, to set benchmarks, like best available technology, that's what's used in the European scheme. The most complicated thing about it is to define what will be the group where the benchmark applies. For example, in electricity, are you applying an electricity standard which is technology neutral? Not looking, you know, at gas, coal, or nuclear, or whatever. Is it going to be, you know, a benchmark which will then really give a few permits per megawatt hour to each of the electricity producers, and so the coal industry wouldn't have enough and would need to buy a lot of them? Or would you go for technology-specific benchmarks? But then you actually lose some of the incentives to swap the technologies, and that's what we actually want. I mean, these are where we can see major emission reduction happening. So lessons learned. There was very little, but there was some abatement in the first phase, although there was an overallocation. When the price was around 20 to 30 euros, we've seen some reductions mainly in unexpected sources, and that's something the emissions trading scheme is really good at. So the market is discovering things you haven't been thinking of before. And these were things like coal to coal, so it was mainly brown to black coal, or it was more biomass co-firing what happened. And yeah, the lessons learned, the cap is very important, because if you don't have a scarcity in the market, you don't have a price. And you have a lot of transaction costs without really achieving anything for the atmosphere, and you will have a lot of, you know, distributional impacts. You will have all these industry giving out, you know, the permits for free, but they're passing through costs, and so you will have households paying for kind of nothing happening to the atmosphere, and that's politically very difficult. But what happened in the European scheme, and that's maybe of interest for people working in Parliament, for example, in Germany, the Parliament was really good in introducing more auctioning, or in introducing auctioning at all. So the scheme which was put in front, like the allocation plan put in front of the German Parliament, was not including any auctioning. And they have now the highest share of auctioning in the European Union, which is about 8%. So there's a chance for Parliament to improve the design. With environmental taxes, this is just very quickly. We've seen the carbon tax in Norway, which was introduced in 1991. Highest, it was about $51 per ton of CO2 in 1990. Average, it was about 21. But despite the carbon tax, we had increases in emissions by 19% over the time, but we had a higher GDP growth, so it was not growing similar. When there was done some simulations on looking at what was really the impact of the carbon tax on the reduction of emissions, so what would have been the growth without the carbon tax, it came out it was about 2.3% of the emissions were reduced through the carbon tax, so we would have had a higher growth of 21.3 otherwise, but only 1.5 came from offshore. From onshore, actually. There was a lot coming from offshore in Norway. The reasons? A lot of the emission-intensive industry was actually exempted. Same thing in Germany. We had introduced one in 1990. Coal is excluded. Just think about that. Yeah, I will try to. And the net burden is actually, there's some exemptions as well. So the manufacturing industry is actually exempted. The administration cost for all these exemptions is also quite high, because a lot of people argue, you know, taxes are so much easier to be administrated. If you have exemptions, it can be substantial, the cost of. Looking at international agreements really quickly, international agreements, I've been part of the German delegation for 7 years. I can't imagine that anybody is negotiating a carbon tax, a harmonized carbon tax. It's just not possible. 180 countries, even if you only take the developed world, you wouldn't get a harmonized carbon tax. And if it's not harmonized, it's inefficient. We've seen the European Union try to, you know, with their member states, and there were only 15 or so, to negotiate a carbon tax, they failed. It needed about 10 years, and they came up with a minimal compromise, which is meaningless. Scandinavian, same problem. Although you would think, you know, same culture, same development level, it would be easy. No, they couldn't reach that. And I think the problem lies in the fact that it's so obvious. You can see what will be the price impact. And it's not like in emissions trading where the market will work out the price and you can't blame the politicians for the price. You can blame the politicians very easily for the price in a carbon tax. Voluntary action, that's very quickly going to what Richard was saying. The problem here is, even with the tax, because you have a Kyoto cap, you would have the impact that if you do something voluntarily, unless you're reducing and buying permits out of the scheme and retiring them, you couldn't do a difference. The government has to act here, and you know they might be really a solution for that dilemma of having not stringent enough targets. There could be a reserve established, which, you know, when you do voluntary action, the government would actually take these CPRS units and also Kyoto units out there and cancel them. And that could be a solution to, at the same time, having a higher target, but at the same time as well, being able to show voluntary action. We've seen some of these examples in Europe. And with the recession, the important thing is emissions trading is cyclical. So you actually don't need to worry because the prices have fallen. You can see this in the European scheme. They have below 10 euros. Conclusions, and I'm very much supporting what Richard was saying. We have a problem if you lock in the wrong targets and the wrong policy for a long, long time. I really believe we need to have pilot phases or things like that. We shouldn't do anything for 10 years' time, although the industry will say, yeah, we need investment certainty. But the problem is we don't have that certainty. Otherwise, it's the, you know, it's you and I bearing that uncertainty because the government is using our tax money to balance it out for the Kyoto or the following international target. I haven't seen any emissions trading scheme without problems, but they have been resolved over time. Taxes, I must say, I haven't seen that they were substantially adapted, so you know that they were getting rid of all the people with exemptions. So I don't really know how they work in the long term. Multinational schemes are possible, and actually what's so nice about the European scheme and the international market, you might end up with the same price because everybody will have the Kyoto price at its margin. You know, it could be that everybody has the CDM price at its margin, and then all the systems, although they are not directly linked, will have the same price. But yeah, so my final conclusion is we need to look at a coherent policy mix. A price instrument will be part of it. We shouldn't waste time debating carbon tax versus emissions trading. We should fix what we've got, and we should make sure that we are not logging into something what we don't want to have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Regina. And we do have a little bit of time for a couple of questions. So does anyone have a question? Yes.
Thanks very much. My name is Irene Cavallini. I'm from the WA Council of Social Services. The question is for Danny, I think.
Okay. Danny?
Thanks. I interpreted your intensity-based approach as a sector and performance-based carbon trading scheme of some kind. I don't know if I've interpreted you correctly, but I'm wondering if that's the case. Are you suggesting that the trading would only happen within sectors once the emissions intensity target's set, or the intensity target of whatever you're talking about, or would it also happen between sectors? And if between sectors, you're suggesting a sector could only sell if it's met its own emissions intensity that you're talking about, or would you enable that trading to happen regardless of whether a sector has met its target, so it's still the trade between sectors?
No, it's definitely between sectors across the economy. The fact that you set a benchmark, just that tells you how many the supply and the demand in each of those sectors. But a permit created in one sector is fungible, homogeneous. Could be traded across the entire country and internationally. There's no reason why it can't be. So as a trading within a sector would just create inefficiency, so that wouldn't work.
And if I can just follow up, so the argument against that historically has been we want to pursue least cost abatement, so we don't want to be setting sectoral based targets within a trading scheme. What's your argument against that?
No. So the trading, to the extent that there are efficiencies because you're shifting both the supply and demand between the most efficient sectors, you've got to retain all that. I completely agree. And setting a benchmark for each sector or activity or whatever, that doesn't stop that from happening. It just, you know, to the extent that it's more efficient to get your abatement from another sector, that will become more and more obvious through the activity of the trading. So just like inevitably under a classic cap and trade, a tax or any scheme, I don't care what politicians will tell you, that target will get shifted, the tax will get changed for a time to achieve the environmental outcome. And the same thing will happen to intensity-based schemes that would with any other scheme.
Any more questions? All right. Well, thank you very much to our three speakers, Danny, Richard and Regina. I think this has been a very informative session, and I'm sure that everyone's got a lot out of it. So could you please join with me and thank our three speakers.
Richard, love it. Good, love it. Good, you chose the rest of me that.
Yeah.